The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. It's another beautiful day here at Edstone. The youth camp is in full swing and been going, well, as far as what everything I've seen, been going very well. We had a fish and chips and campfire and Shakespeare activity with the campers last night, so something a little unusual, hopefully cultural, hopefully enjoyable. Well, today, though, on today's show, I'd like to talk to you or begin by talking to you about some news from a country that I'm sure is absolutely top of your news watching priority list. It is, oh, I can make my own sound effects here, Uzbekistan. Now, in case Uzbekistan is not at the absolute top of your news-watching list, it's a former Soviet country in Central Asia, and Uzbekistan has a new cabinet minister. The unusual thing about him, he was appointed earlier this month, is that he's a German civil servant. Carsten Heinz worked in the, as official, a bureaucrat in the Federal Ministry of Education and Research in Germany. But he's moving now to Uzbekistan to be a minister in their government. It's something like deputy minister for research and development. German Foreign Policy noted, it is the first time that a German receives such a high government office in another country. Actually, that analysis there from them is a little short-sighted, and we will see why as we go through today's, or a little short on the memory, and we'll see why as we go through today's show. So why take an interest in a German moving to Uzbekistan? Well, this is part of an important pattern, both in older history with Germany and recent history with Germany working with Russia. Uzbekistan is a close Russian ally there in Central Europe. And if you watch the Key of David program this weekend, you'll be very familiar with this subject. If not, please go back. It was a milestone. Well, all the Key of David programs are really good, but this was a kind of a milestone Key of David program. And please make sure that you hear that at the Trumpet website. The trumpet.com. You click on the Key of David or from the editor tab, and you'll be able to find that. But to give you a taste of that, if you've not seen it, or to introduce this subject to remind you of it, here's a clip from the start of that Key of David program.
But here now we see Germany going to Russia and building this tight little relationship with a country who is, well, committing a lot of terrorism himself in Syria and poisoning former agents of Russia, destroying them and poisoning them with something like a small little nuclear power. That's what it amounts to. I mean, this is brutal. Can we really build a relationship with somebody who thinks like that and who murders people, and he's murdered at least 130 journalists, they tell us? Can we really build a close relationship with someone like that? Well, you know it's not going to end well. But here we have Germany paying only about one half of what they should be paying, I mean the minimum, to NATO, and they have never ever paid it. They won't even pay it. Why not? Since it's mainly to protect them, and we've let them get away with it, and now Mr. Trump has called them out on that, and I think rightfully so. But think about this. They're going to get 70% of their gas from that pipeline coming directly from Russia right on down where it will serve just Germany itself. That's the plan. So here we have Vladimir Putin thinking about, well, he's resurrecting this old Soviet empire. And you have another group of people, Germany and their allies. Well, they want to build the Holy Roman Empire, the seventh head of that most destructive empire throughout history. So let's take a look at Germany and Russia's secret war against America. We need to understand this.
So we need to understand this, Mr. Flurry was saying at the end there. He has an article in the upcoming Trumpet print edition on the same subject, and he begins, "We need to carefully watch what is happening right now between Germany and Russia." Mr. Flurry went on in that program to talk about this critical pipeline deal that's going on between Germany and Russia, where these two countries are really working together in a close and a special way, and we'll talk more a bit about that towards the end of the show. And Germany's ex-chancellor is even working essentially for the Russian government on this pipeline. So you've got close cooperation between Russia and Germany. You've got politicians from Germany, like Germany's ex-chancellor, going to Russia. You've got now even a German civil servant becoming a minister in Uzbekistan, a country very close to Russia, Russia's government. And so I'd like today to help you understand this by looking at Russian and German history. Because if you're a student of this history, everything that we're seeing right now is very, very familiar and teaches us some very important lessons. I think it really is some fascinating history, and I'm excited to get into this with you today because I think it really does bring alive what Mr. Flurry says in that Key of David, what he says in that article, and it just helps us understand the importance of what we're seeing right now between Russia and Germany and gives us just a really complete picture of what is happening. Over the centuries, Russia has been Germany's nemesis, its greatest and most feared enemy. And at the same time, Germany's probably had no closer friend than Russia. So let's look at the history of this love-hate relationship between Germany and Russia, these best of frenemies, you could say, and how that relationship is once again going to shake the world. We'll start our history around the 1500s. So Russia at this time is emerging from a couple of centuries of Mongol rule. As they came out of this time, they felt themselves kind of technologically, socially behind the rest of Europe because they'd just been under the occupation of the Mongols for so long. And it was a tough time for Russia to emerge from this. And this is really kind of the foundation of the more modern Russian state. You had a couple of Ivans, the last one being pretty terrible. Quite literally, that was his name, or what he became known as, Ivan the Terrible. After him, you had civil war. So, you know, it was a very tough time for Russia. Despotism, civil war, reigns of terror, etc. And at the same time, it was a time of expansion for Germans. Not Germany. At this time, Germany doesn't exist in its modern form. Germany is divided into, in some cases, some time periods, hundreds of states, mostly part of the Holy Roman Empire. But the Germans were going through this through a process known as Ostsiedlung, settling eastwards. So Germany was relatively prosperous. It had lots of good farmland, and therefore it had lots of people. Meanwhile, to the east, things were pretty tough. The east was much more vulnerable to raids from nomads, raids from people like the Mongols. It was emptier. And so the Germans pushed east, many of the from the more populous Germany to the more sparser territories in the east. And often rulers in the east invited them in Eastern Europe and even on into Russia. They had empty land. Empty land doesn't pay taxes. Land that's being farmed does. So they were only too happy to invite and even encourage Germans to come to move in, to farm the land, and then also to defend the land. You had, for example, quite a large number of what are called Wehrkirchen, war churches, built across in Romania and other parts of Eastern Europe, where German farmers would come in and they'd build fortified churches to help defend the areas from raids from nomads, from quote-unquote barbarians and some of these other powers in the east. You had an especially high concentration of Germans in Transylvania, in Romania, best known as the home of Dracula, I guess. But there was a lot of Germans in that area, in the Baltic states, around Latvia, Lithuania. You had the Teutonic Knights carve themselves out, a little German-ruled kingdom up there. And then at the same time, as well as bringing just people and defense, they brought their technology and their farming techniques, their industrial techniques. So local rulers encouraged this Ostsiedlung, this movement of Germans out to the east. And there were a lot moving to Russia as well. And these two trends, this kind of revival of Russia after being ruled by the Mongols and this German spread east, they really came together in the late 1600s. In 1672, Peter the Great came to the throne. And he decided it was time to make some big changes in Russia. Russia was a large country, the largest country in the world. It was stretching all the way to the Pacific. But most of the population worked in agriculture. A lot of it was empty and sparsely populated. Trade was limited. And Peter the Great decided he wanted to make Russia more European. And he began by moving Russia to Europe, quite literally. He fought Sweden to gain access to the Baltic. Then he built a new capital city in St. Petersburg on the Baltic coast, much closer to Europe, much better for trading links for Europe than Moscow. He copied the government after the kind of more modern or fashionable European models of the time, reorganized local and national government and the law, etc. Meanwhile, at the same time, German influence in Russia was strong. By about 1680, about 10% of Moscow's population, according to some estimates, was German. So just a huge German minority there. And so when Peter wanted to modernize his country, well, Germany was the natural place to turn to for help in doing that. He drew on all of Europe, but he brought back especially a lot of experts from Germany into Russia. And he drew close to those German states. His only son and heir was married into the German house of Brunswick-Lüneburg. His daughters were betrothed to princes, his two surviving daughters. They were betrothed to princes from another German principality, Holstein-Gottorp. German advisors flowed into Russia to help him to build the empire. He brought in Germans to help modernize the army, to help Russia become more scientific, more industrial. But then, after he died, the pendulum swung back and Russia kind of turned or started to fear Germany. And what you see in this is that, well, I want to say you see this constant pendulum swing. Really, that metaphor and that mental image is completely wrong for the changes that we'll see in the relationship between Germany and Russia. Because, you know, with a pendulum swing, it kind of gently reaches one extreme and comes to a rest and then starts slowly and then quicker and quicker moving back in the other direction. That's not the relationship between Russia and Germany. Instead, you just see these massive and almost instant changes between friend and enemy with almost no warning, incredibly abrupt. It's more of a whiplash between being friend and enemy. And with the death of Peter, we see one of these first whiplash changes. The Empress Elizabeth was one of Peter's daughters, and she was one of the ones who'd been engaged to marry a German prince. That German prince had died before the wedding could happen. And she and many others in Russia began to fear Germany, especially the strongest and most powerful of all the German states at the time, Prussia. So now it gets a little confusing because we're talking about Russia and Prussia, and I am very good at muddling up names when I am talking and often say one when I mean the other, and I'm sure that's going to be really helpful. But you know, Prussia was a state in East Germany, northeastern Poland, or what's now northeastern Poland. It was ruled at this time in the mid and early 1700s by Frederick the Great of Prussia. And this was the rising German state. It was gobbling up lands, gobbling up other German states. And so many in Russia began to fear Prussia. They started to think, well, they saw the power that Germans had just within the Russian government itself and within Russia, because they had so many of these top positions. They had so many advisors over there. They saw the power Prussia was gaining in Europe, and they feared that Prussia could become a danger to the Russian Empire. In the mid-17th century, war loomed, and Russia signed an alliance with Austria and France against Prussia. And in 1756, the Seven Years' War broke out. Winston Churchill, in his History of the English-Speaking Peoples, he called the Seven Years' War the first truly world war. It saw Britain and France fight all around the world, from Canada to India and even further east. Prussia was allied with Britain, and then Russia was allied with France, and also with Austria. So generally, Britain and France fought kind of around the world, and meanwhile, Prussia and Russia fought within Europe. The war went well for England, but Prussia really felt the pressure from Russia. Frederick the Great, in the beginning of 1760, he wrote, "I'm at the end of my resources. The continuance of this war means for me utter ruin. Things may drag on perhaps till July, but then a catastrophe must come." So Prussia was at danger of collapsing. This could have been the end for them and their ambitions in being the most powerful German state, creating all of this power in Europe. They wanted peace with Russia, but the Empress Elizabeth in Russia, she was determined to continue the war until Prussia was reduced to a size and a power where it could no longer be a threat to Russia. Now, Frederick the Great and Prussia, they managed to hold on, but things were still pretty desperate. At the start of 1962, he wrote, "We ought now to think of preserving for my nephew, by way of negotiation, whatever fragments of my territory we can save from the avidity of my enemies." So he's kind of now just like, well, hopefully we can still keep something together and avoid total destruction. Even at this point, he's saying, we ought to think now of preserving for my nephew here. He didn't think he personally would survive the war. Prussia had lost over 100,000 men at this point. And then in 1762, just weeks after Frederick wrote this, you have the whiplash again. And relations between Germany and Russia suddenly completely change. The Empress Elizabeth dies. And Elizabeth was unmarried. She had no legitimate children, so she chose her nephew for an heir, the daughter of Elizabeth's sister. And you may remember, we mentioned earlier, Elizabeth's sister had been betrothed, and in this case actually married, to a German prince. So her nephew, Peter, he was born in Germany. He spoke fluent German, and his Russian actually wasn't very good. He spoke German much better. He'd been married to a German princess, Princess Sophia of Anhalt-Zerbst, and when she converted to Russian Orthodox religion, she changed her name to Catherine. So the heir now to the Russian throne, born in Germany, spoke much better German than Russian, had a German wife, a German father. You basically had a German coming onto the throne of Russia. And so suddenly relations between Germany and Russia and between Russia and Prussia went from catastrophic to ecstatic, or as close as they could possibly be. Russia had been right on the brink of breaking the power of the most German state. And suddenly now, within just almost overnight, they became allies. The Russian soldiers switched sides. In the Seven Years' War, they stopped conquering Prussia and they started helping Prussia. Prussia recaptured some of the territory it's lost. Austria was forced to make peace with Prussia. And then the relationship would soon get even closer, because the Russians weren't really too keen, or a lot within the high echelons of Russia weren't too keen on the Emperor Peter III. And within 6 months, they decided they wanted to get rid of him. His wife, Catherine, helped organize a coup. Peter III was arrested, subsequently killed, and his wife, Catherine, became the Empress Catherine. So now you have the ruler of Russia. She wasn't a blood descendant from Russia's royal family at all. She was a German princess who happened to have married the heir to the Russian throne. So Russia was now being ruled basically by a German empress. So you see already just this dizzying change. And we're familiar with some of these rapid changings of sides between friends and enemies with Russia and Germany in the 20th century. But this pattern has a long history. And so within just months, Russia and Germany had gone from fighting to the death to being about as close allies as you could possibly get. And so Catherine invited in Europeans. Her main target was Germans, but she opened it up to all Europeans to come and live in Russia. She said, come to Russia, come move to Russia. You can keep speaking your native language. You can keep your culture. We'll give a set amount of land to every family that moves. Everybody that came would be exempt from conscription. So unlike the Russians, they wouldn't have to serve in the Russian army. They'd be exempt from a whole load of taxes. They would have a lot of rights to govern themselves. They would have relative religious freedom. And so you had this huge influx then of Germans moving into Russia, accepting this invitation for land within Russia. They brought a lot of their industry and their expertise with them, which is exactly what Catherine wanted. She wanted them to help Russia's kind of industrial development, and even with agricultural technologies. A lot of people that were facing more religious persecution within Germany, Mennonites and some of these kind of religious minorities and Baptists, they accepted this offer and moved into Russia. By the time Russia took its first census in the late 1800s, so a lot later, there were around 2 million living in Russia that listed Germany as their first language. You had, right the way up really until the Second World War, whole communities, towns and villages in various parts of Russia that were German, where almost everyone there considered themselves ethnically German, spoke German. And really, you had this throughout Eastern Europe, in Romania, in Transylvania, in some of these Baltic states, from this spreading out to the east that came from Germany. But Catherine's alliance with Germany continued on the international level. She got together with Austria and Prussia, and the three of them just decided to divide Poland up between them. Again, this may sound familiar with more modern history, but they basically just all sat down with a map and it was, well, you take that bit, I'll take that bit, and I'll take that bit. And you know, they negotiated. They did this three times until eventually there was nothing of Poland left. And all three of them had completely divided up all of Poland. And this wasn't just Catherine being nice to Prussia because she was German. You know, she's known as Catherine the Great in Russian history, because Russia really benefited from this foreign policy. With a secure treaty with Germany, Russia was able to expand elsewhere. Catherine went to war with the Ottoman Turks and won. She went to war with Persia. She took new territory in the Caucasus. And with that alliance with Prussia, Russia was able just to hugely expand. The Encyclopedia Britannica wrote that Russians, even Soviet Russians, continue to admire Catherine, the German usurper and profligate, and regard her as a source of national pride. They write, or the encyclopedia writes, at the end of Catherine's reign, Russia had expanded westwards and southwards over an area of more than 200,000 square miles. So this alliance with Prussia had helped them conquer a huge amount of territory. And the Russian ruler's ancient dream of access to the Bosporus Strait, connecting the Black Sea with the Aegean, had become an attainable goal. At the end of her reign, Catherine claimed that she had reorganized 29 provinces under her administrative reform plan. An uninhibited spender, she invested funds in many projects. More than 100 new towns were built, old ones were expanded and renovated. As commodities were plentiful, trade expanded and communications developed. These achievements, together with the glory of military victories and the fame of a brilliant court to which the greatest minds of Europe were drawn, have won her a distinguished place in history. And yeah, I believe it's people like Leonard Euler, the famous German mathematician. He was one of the luminaries in Catherine's court. Purely from memory. I'm pretty sure that's right. So you had lots of these experts being drawn to Russia. And then Prussia benefited as well. And remember, they'd been on the brink of complete annihilation. But then this treaty with Russia had saved them. Then they'd gotten their bits of Poland that they wanted. They'd been able to expand. They'd been able to really cement their position as the leading German state. So both of them had benefited from this close alliance. Well, we're about halfway through the show. We'll take a quick pause there, we'll have a break, and when we get back, we'll continue our history of Russia and German relations and this the whiplashes between friend and enemy.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is The Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
While today with Richard Palmer, we left the... played the wrong singer for you, I'm afraid. But we're discussing the history of German-Russian relations and how they've just whiplashed between being friends and enemies. We just discussed Catherine the Great and the sudden change in relations between Russia and Germany that happened when she came to power. After she died, Alexander the First became Tsar, the Russian Emperor. And he reiterated Catherine's invitation for Germany to move west. He issued it again, and there was another influx of more Germans moving to Russia. And by the time of the Napoleonic Wars at the start of the 1800s, many of Russia's top generals were German. There's even a line in Tolstoy's War and Peace where one of the Russian generals kind of complains and asks the Russian emperor to promote him to the rank of German, because he's jealous of just the influence that the Germans have within the Russian army and really within the whole nation. During those wars when Prussia made peace with France, quite a few Prussian officers went to Russia so they could keep fighting, including the now very famous Karl von Clausewitz. They wanted to they wanted to keep the war going, and they were quite happy serving in the Russian army where so many other Germans were serving. After the war, Russia concluded the Holy Alliance with Austria and Prussia, where these monarchies agreed to help each other stamp down on revolutionary movements across Europe. So with that alliance in place with Germany and with Austria, Russia was able to fight back attempts from Persia to retake territory in the Caucasus, and they were able to push... Persia had some success, but Russia was able to push back. They were able to continue expanding at just a huge pace into Central Asia and really take advantage of this and keep pushing in the east, because their borders in the west with Germany were secured through this alliance. And for a good chunk of the 19th century, Russia and Germany remained allied. A good part of the reason for this was that the German Prussian Chancellor Otto von Bismarck wanted to unite Germany. He wanted to bring all of the German states together under Prussian unity. And he knew that Russia could be a huge threat to that and to Prussia. He used outside powers that he could beat, like France and like Austria, to help kind of pressure Germany to unite against a common enemy. But he feared he couldn't beat Russia. So he wanted to lead Prussia to take over Germany. And for that to happen, he needed Russia to stay out of it. And he even said the secret of politics is to make a good treaty with Russia. So he made sure he had peace so that Germany could gain its way, Prussia could gain its way to dominate Germany and then become the most powerful nation in Europe. It was that alliance with Russia that really helped, and that Bismarck gave a lot of credit for helping them to do that. Towards the end of the 20th century, this began to break down. Russia started to fear the growing power of Germany and so signed a treaty with France. And the Germans became worried too. They feared that Russia was so big and so powerful that they were just going to dominate the world. And they thought that, well, maybe we can stop Russia now, but if we leave it too late, Russia's going to be unstoppable. And so the result was World War I, which Germany comprehensively won in the East at first. By 1917, they'd pushed Russia so hard that the country had collapsed into revolution, and Germany was able to sign a peace treaty with the revolutionary government, and they were able to get pretty much everything they'd wanted at the start of the war in the East. All they had to do now was make a peace with Britain and France and America, and they would have won the war. But they didn't. They lost, they were defeated in the West, and they lost those massive conquests that they thought they'd had in the East. And after World War I, everyone just kind of assumed that Russia and Germany were mortal enemies. I mean, they basically kind of destroyed each other fighting during World War I. Russia had been forced into that humiliating peace. Before then, Germany had been forced into its own humiliating peace. And even their ideologies, you know, communism preached constantly of war against all of these other nations and not getting along with non-communist governments. So everyone kind of thought, well, Russia and Germany, they could never be friends, right? But that doesn't take into account this love-hate relationship that we've seen throughout history between Russia and Germany. In the period after World War II after World War I was absolutely no exception to that rule. Now, it's important to remember how Russia fell apart in 1917. You had a certain Russian revolutionary living in Germany. In February 1917, revolution broke out in Russia, and Germany saw an opportunity. They allowed this Russian revolutionary to get on a train, and they helped him travel to Russia, despite the fact that Germany was at war with Russia. They facilitated his return to Russia, and that revolutionary's name was Vladimir Lenin. And he was the one that it paid off wonderfully for Germany at first. You know, what happened for Germany was almost a repeat of the Seven-Year War. You have an anti-German government disappear, collapse in revolution in this case, and a much more pro-German government come to power. Lenin wanted peace with Germany so he could focus on the communist revolution, and Germany gave it to him. So even though many people they thought they couldn't get along, Lenin and Germany pretty much got along fine. I mean, Lenin wasn't as friendly to Germany as Catherine the Great was, and you know, or especially because Russia had had to give up so much territory to Germany. But there were still some relations there. And this was crucial for German rearmament after World War I. You know, both Russia and Germany, I mean, Russia was technically on the winning side, but they'd had the Russian Revolution. Both were excluded from the League of Nations. Both kind of almost had the emerged from that as defeated powers. And so they began working together once again to help each other rise up from that defeat. The Treaty of Versailles after World War I, it limited the size of the German armed forces, and Germany worked with Russia almost right away to start getting around that and breaking that treaty. Way before Hitler came into power, they began working with Russia. On April 16th, 1922, Germany and Russia signed the Treaty of Rapallo. And there was a kind of a public part of the treaty, and the public part, this was a fairly standard rapprochement between Russia and Germany, kind of detailing their relationship now that they recognized each other and things out of the war. But there were secret clauses. Germany would carry out military research, development, and training, which had all been outlawed by Versailles, in Russia, secretly. And then in exchange, Russia would share in the military advances, train alongside the German army. So both of them secretly worked to undermine the League of Nations. They both secretly worked together and conspired against the West. And this was signed in 1922. Hitler didn't come to power until the early 1930s. It was about a decade before any of this came out. I mean, there were hints and there were glimpses of what was going on here. But it was this secret treaty that really helped And it was part of what helped Russia, Germany just to burst onto the scene once Hitler came into the power. I'll read what Paul Johnson writes about this relationship in his book Modern Times. And he wrote, Lenin, however, was not without secret friends abroad. The links of self-interest established between his regime and the German military in November 1917 seem to have been maintained, albeit sometimes in tenuous form, even after the armistice. German military assistance to the Bolsheviks is frequently referred to by British officers advising Denikin and other white commanders. So the Germans helped Lenin win the Russian Civil War. So the help took the immediate form of Freikorps officers, munitions, and in due course, industrial expertise in building new war factories. So once again, German experts traveling to Russia to help them build up their industry and develop their army. The last point, Paul Johnson writes, was vital to the Germans, who under the Versailles Treaty had to dismantle their armaments industry. By secretly coaching the Bolsheviks in arms technology and developing new weapons in Russia, they were maintaining a continuity of skills which, when the time was ripe, could once more be openly exploited back at home. So they both benefited from this. Thus, writes Paul Johnson, a strange covert alliance was formed, which occasionally broke surface, as at the Rapallo Conference in 1922, and still more sensationally in August 1939, but which for most of the time was carefully hidden. A working relationship of generals, arms experts, later of secret police, which was continue in one form or another until the 22nd of June, 1941. It is one of the ironies of history that German specialists first taught Soviet communism how to make excellent tanks, a weapon used to overwhelm Germany in 1943-45. So there's definitely, you see again this whiplash relationship. The deeper irony, he writes, is that this was a marriage of class enemies. What could be further apart than Prussian generals and Bolsheviks? Yet in the final crisis and aftermath of the war, both groups saw themselves and certainly were seen as outlaws. There was a spirit of gangster fraternization in their arrangements, the first of many such Europe was to experience over the next 20 years. So Germany was able to build up this relationship, build up secret airfields, and really prepare in secret for launching World War II. And as I said, this was long before Hitler came to power. Germany, they began training pilots at the Lipetsk Air Base in Russia. They also trained pilots in civilian glider clubs as well. But you see the same patterns that we've seen in this relationship for centuries. Sharing technology, Germany helping Russia develop technologically, Germany helping Russia's military to develop, and then Germany getting protection, Germany getting these benefits from Russia. So this was a really close relationship. So you had the treaty in Rapallo in 1922, and then in 1939, this got even closer. You had Germany and Russia sign the Hitler-Stalin Pact, or the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. I'll read what Paul Johnson talks about with this pact. And again, he summarizes this wasn't just one pact. Sometimes I think we do kind of think of Germany and Russia's relationship at this time just being there was this surprise pact in August 1939. But there were several decades of close connections between the two, very secret connections, where they'd worked together for years before signing this pact. And you had to look very carefully for the signs to see any evidence of it before it emerged. And it emerged very suddenly with the invasion of Poland in September 1939. But there was this long-standing relationship. So Paul Johnson writes that this pact was the accumulation of a series of contacts between the Soviet and German governments, which went right back to the weeks following Lenin's putsch. They had been conducted, according to need, by army experts, secret policemen, diplomats, or intermediaries on the fringe of the criminal world. They had been closer at some points than others, but they'd never been wholly broken. And they had been characterized throughout by total disregard for the ideological principles which either party ostensibly professed, by a contempt, indeed, for any consideration other than the most brutal mutual interest. the need of each regime to arm and arrest and kill its opponents and oppress its neighbors. For two decades, this evil stream of exchanges had flowed underground. Now, at last, it broke the surface. That night of the 23rd to 24th of August, it talks about the kind of the party there and the camaraderie even that seemed to exist between the Nazis and the Soviets at that time. He writes that Ribbentrop there was as much at ease in the Kremlin as among his old Nazi friends. Or Ribbentrop himself said that. There are all of these toasts. And he writes, as the tipsy killers lurched about the room, fumbling, hugging each other, they resembled nothing so much as a congregation of rival gangsters who had fought each other before and might do so again, but were essentially in the same racket. The agreement, he writes, was termed a non-aggression pact. In fact, it was a simple aggression pact against Poland. So the secret part of this pact didn't emerge even until 1945. But they'd agreed to divide Eastern Europe between the two. Russia wouldn't oppose Germany invading Poland. Germany wouldn't oppose Russia invading the other half of Poland, invading Finland and other parts of Eastern Europe. And it went way further, though, than just dividing Eastern Europe. It was a much deeper and more comprehensive treaty than just that. Paul Johnson writes, all over the world, communist parties reversed their anti-Nazi policy, preaching world peace with Germany at any price and actively sabotaging the war effort when it came. At the height of the Nazi invasion of France, Maurice Forez, head of the French Communist Party, broadcast from Moscow, begging the French troops not to resist. So they started working to undermine, Russia started working to undermine the West on behalf of Germany as part of this secret treaty. Stalin, writes Paul Johnson, placed at Hitler's disposal all the immense raw material resources of the Soviet Union. This was vital to Hitler. So there was the propaganda, but then also just this huge amount of raw materials. In September 1939, Germany needed to import 80% of its rubber, 65% of its tin, 70% of its copper, half its lead, a quarter of its zinc, writes Paul Johnson. And he got a lot of, he goes on to say he got a lot of that from Switzerland, but then he writes, but Stalin filled equally important gaps in Hitler's war supplies. 1 million tons of grain, 900,000 tons of oil, including 100,000 tons of aircraft fuel, additional iron ore, manganese, and cotton. In return, Russia got aero engines, naval blueprints, torpedoes, and mines. So you see this relationship where Russia gets Germany expertise, Germany gets Russian raw material. Well, that sounds pretty similar to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline deal. Germany getting Russia raw material in the form of gas, and they're importing more and more Russian oil. Russia getting German expertise and German weapons, German support. So the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, it was this massive deal between the two. Then, in 1941, everything changed. You had, again, the whiplash changing direction, this time from Germany. Overnight, going from Russia's best friend to completely anti-Russia. And it was so quick that it caught Stalin completely by surprise. And really, there was no good reason for it to catch him by surprise. Andrew Roberts, in his History of World War II, The Storm of War, he writes, Soviet dispositions are all the more inexplicable considering that Barbarossa, this invasion of Russia, was the worst-kept secret of the Second World War, and Stalin received no fewer than 80 warnings of Hitler's intentions over the previous 8 months. He was warned by his own spies. He was warned by counterintelligence agencies in Berlin, in Washington, in Eastern Europe. The British ambassador warned him. Even the German ambassador in Moscow warned him. He wasn't a huge fan of the Nazis, so he warned the Russians. Germany's own ambassador warned the Russians that the Germans were going to invade. They still didn't believe him. The day before the invasion, the NKVD, Russia's secret police, they reported no fewer than 39 aircraft incursions. It was so much of a shock that when the invasion did come, one Russian unit, they telephoned the HQ saying, well, we're being fired at by Germany. What do we do? And the reply came back from the general headquarters, you must be insane. And why isn't your signal in code? So when they started, even when Russian troops started saying, the Germans are invading, they're firing on us, the reply they got from the headquarters was, well, you must be crazy. The Germans are our friends. That's how quick and how sudden the change was. I mean, Stalin, it seems like he almost had some kind of mental breakdown. He just seemed to be pale and unable to understand that there'd been a declaration of war. Just a massive change. Now, of course, Germany lost that war. Russia won, and it was absolutely catastrophic for Germany. 4 out of every 5 German soldiers killed during World War II died on the Eastern Front. Absolutely massive casualties. But Paul Johnson makes the argument in that book that in The Storm of War, that if Hitler had done a few things differently, if they'd have been a little more urgent in getting to Moscow, had taken fewer detours in getting to places like Moscow and Stalingrad, that they could have won the war, that they could have taken all of Russia east of the Urals, pushed Russia out back behind the Urals, and had victory. Especially when they had so much success with that initial surprise attack. But Russia, with having had all that help from Germany to train its military, to learn how to build and use tanks before the war, they were able to come back with some excellent tanks and beat Germany. And then came the Cold War. Germany was divided. But still, there was this sense that Germany could switch sides. Starting especially in the 70s, you had the rise of Ostpolitik, Eastpolitik, with the thinking within Germany, well, that Germany could have a much less adversarial relationship with the Soviet Union. They didn't have to be firmly in the West. They could move closer to the Soviet Union. They could perhaps even switch sides and break up the NATO alliance. During the Cold War, Hans J. Morgenthau wrote in his book Politics Among Nations, where he talked about how, well, he wrote, the decline of American power and influence therefore tilts the balance of power in favor of the Soviet Union and in consequence increases the insecurity of Western Europe. And he talks about how if Europe was worried that America might pull out, well, they would cut loose from the U.S. and would have to accommodate themselves to the Soviets. And he writes that this accommodation, were the Federal Republic of Germany to join it, would signify a drastic change in the distribution of world power. This would have a huge impact on world power. The Western orientation of the FRG, the Federal Republic of Germany, had been derived from calculations of comparative military, political, and economic advantage. Well, he talks about a vote in 1983 where a substantial number of the Social Democratic Party voted against deploying Cruise and Pershing 2 missiles. And he talked about how, well, that was a sign that some within Germany were thinking about, were willing to switch sides and go over to Russia. And it's the Social Democratic former chancellor that's been best buddies with Putin more recently. And he talked about how there was a very real prospect at that time of Germany switching sides. It's traditionally fearful of the Russian bear, a West Germany deprived of assured American protection would be driven into a neutral, if not friendly, political and military position with respect to its towering neighbor on the east. That position would be greatly strengthened by the complementary relationship of the West German and Soviet economies. As the European pipeline dispute in the early 1980s made clear, the Soviet Union had obviously decided to supplement its own efforts in industrial modernization with a massive influx of Western technology. The Federal Republic is one of those most developed industrial nations depending on large-scale exports for its prosperity. Once the political, military, and economic ties among the Western European nations and between them and the United States were loosened, the Soviet Union could offer a profitable alternative. So during the Cold War, there was that temptation. Because throughout history, there has been this this complementary economic interest between Germany and Russia. Russia needs expertise, it needs people, it needs modern machinery. Germany needs raw materials, and it wants to be able to sell final products. And it fits together perfectly. Russia's got lots of raw materials. Germany needs them. Germany's got generally lots of expertise, lots of finished manufactured products. Russia needs that. And so that brings us to the present situation, where Germany is in the Western camp, ostensibly, and increasingly doing deals with Russia. And this the complementary economics that we've seen for hundreds of years still exists. So Mr. Florian, that Key of David program, he talked about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which travels under the Baltic from Russia to Germany. The Poles and others in Eastern Europe call it the Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline, hearkening back to that pact between Russia and Germany, because they see what it is. They see the close relationship that these two are building and how important that pipeline is. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard last year, he wrote about some of this and their objections. And he wrote that the Nord Stream 2 venture creates a sweetheart arrangement with Germany while undermining the security and economic interests of Eastern and Central Europe and leaves Ukraine at the mercy of Kremlin blackmail. What is strange is that Berlin seems determined to press ahead with this divisive undertaking when 8 East European states have protested bitterly and Poland is resorting to every legal challenge to block it. The saga is a raw example of how Berlin captures the EU machinery. Brussels set aside EU law on Nord Stream, yet enforced it on other pipelines such as Yamal and South Stream. Solidarity and the rule of law in the EU only applies only when the Kanzleramt, or basically when Germany, chooses. He concludes by writing, "The collective feeling in Washington is that American democracy has been raped by Kremlin cyber aggression. A state of political warfare exists between the US and Russia. We know which side Poland is on. Which side is Germany on?" Not even sure which side Germany is on anymore when it comes to this relationship between Germany and Russia. And Mr. Flurry talked about this pipeline deal in that Key of David, and it's the cover article for the Trumpet print magazine. I'd urge you to really make sure you read that. I was just looking through one of the drafts of that this morning, and it's a really beefy, lots of big, substantial news articles in there. Really excited about this issue. And the cover issue is that one for Mr. Flurry. Make sure you read that. But in return for this, Germany, with its manufacturing powerhouse, is getting the best cheap natural gas from Europe. Bloomberg had an article a couple of months ago, or from Russia. So Bloomberg had an article, though. Germany's $10 billion gas bill shows perks of close Russia ties. So their manufacturing export powerhouse is being fueled by cheap raw materials from Russia. Meanwhile, European companies are providing technology and know-how Russia needs. For example, you've got a lot of European oil and gas companies who are finding ways around American sanctions to help Russia drill in the Arctic. There was an industrial newspaper. They wrote this: Siemens probably has one of the best and closest relationships to the Kremlin of any foreign company working in Russia. Siemens, this big German powerhouse, one of their key nations of their Wirtschaftswunder, their manufacturing miracles, one of their big industrial companies they're proud of. The relationship was brokered by Gerhard Schröder, the former German chancellor and subsequent buddy of President Vladimir Putin, who would personally attend meetings between Siemens CEO and Putin when they were discussing business. So this is the same guy, Gerhard Schröder, who works with the pipeline deal. He's helping bring in German expertise into Russia and helping companies like Siemens really get involved in Russia. This article goes on to write, and that relationship has been extremely lucrative. Russian turbine technology is not a patch on the German version, and as part of a massive overhaul of the power sector in the boom years, Siemens turbines have been installed in an estimated 80% of Russian power stations. So Germany's really helping Russia develop there. Some major infrastructure. And this is a huge risk for the United States, though. This relationship that we see building is something that should really alarm the United States and Britain. And we've seen how Germany and Russia, they both use this to expand. Germany used this to expand by 200,000 miles, just this massive expand, or 200,000 square miles of territory under Catherine the Great, this huge expansion. Bismarck used this alliance to be able to forge Germany into one nation and become the dominant nation in Europe. He was able to go to war with France and completely trounce them, changing the world with their sudden rise. And so if you see an alliance building between these two, again, well, they're both doing it because there were advantages. They're both doing it so that they can secure their mutual, you know, areas of interest so that they can expand elsewhere. Professor Nicholas Spykman, in his book, The Geography of the Peace, he's one of really America's greatest international relations thinkers, and he writes, "Our constant concern in peacetime must be to see that no nation or alliance of nations is allowed to emerge as a dominating power in either of the two regions of the old world from which our security could be threatened. And one of those regions is in Europe." He also wrote that the United States must recognize once again and permanently that the power constellation in Europe and Asia is of everlasting concern to her, both in time of war and in time of peace. He warned that preventing this kind of alliance between Germany and Russia is an absolute prerequisite for the independence of the New World and the preservation of the power position of the United States. And that's what Mr. Flory really focused on in this Key of David and in this article. You know, this is the secret Russia-German war against America. That something along those lines is the title to that Key of David. Wow, I'm very quickly running out of time. Well, we've been... The Plain Truth was writing back in 1962, warning about this alliance. They wrote, "When a Russo-German deal is made, you can be sure that the doom of the United States and Great Britain is on the horizon." That's what this is about. So please, I'm about out of time here, but please go watch that Key of David. Read that article in the upcoming print edition, because this alliance is really something that you need to be watching. Thanks for listening today. And I'm sure Trumpet Executive Editor Stephen Flory will be back tomorrow. So tune in next time on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.